So when the election's over, do we really know what the public has asked the officials to do? Not really. Do something. Now, of all the environments that shape the Texas political system, which one has changed the least over my lifetime, which is the last almost three quarters of a century? Not quite, but close. Have the physical landforms, I guess maybe I'm going to have to take climate off of there in a few years, size, basic transportation, maybe a little bit, natural resources really changed massively? No. Legal constitutional issues? Yes. Social and ethnic? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Economic situation? Oh, definitely, certainement. I think we talked about last time around in the 70s and 80s, the Texas economy hit kind of a wall and started to diversify. If we had had the tremendous drop in oil prices that has occurred in the course of this last year, 50 years ago, Texas would have been in a major recession. But the economy has diversified enough to where that's not the case now. I'm not saying it's not going to hurt. That's clear. It's going to hurt. But into a major recession, probably not. Well, who knows? Up until about the 1950s, the Texas political system was considered to be an elitist system. That is to say, a relatively small group of people, financed primarily by the oil and gas industry, if you want to be truthful about it, held positions both socially and economically, and pretty well dominated the politics of Texas. There were a few reactions to it. If you've studied Texas history, you know there were several reform efforts back about the turn of the century, that is to say between the 19th and the 20th century. Jim Hogg got elected governor, and they got the Railroad Commission established. And then we had several reformers who probably didn't get very far, W. Lee O'Daniel, Jim Ferguson, not much. But politics really begins to change in Texas about the late 60s, early 70s. And we've moved much more to a pluralistic system. Now, I guess what I would be hoping for eventually would be to have a participatory system in which there was widespread distribution of power and universal participation. When we get to the question in a little bit about participation in Texas, how does Texas rank compared with other states in terms of people voting? Top half, bottom half?
Wasn't it all the way at the
bottom? Top quarter, bottom quarter? Actually about the bottom quarter. Now part of that can be explained a number of ways, but let's don't spend time on that now. What's an interest group? It's organized. Now political scientists like to talk about potential interest groups versus organized interest groups. That's not particularly hard to understand, is it? Now, politicians frequently, I think I use the bee analogy, treat interest kind of like a hive of bees. They don't want to stir them up too much. Because you're never real certain if there's a potential group out there, a latent group, that certain actions will cause them to come into existence. So the organized groups make demands on political institutions and have shared attitudes and concerns. Now, how they go about doing that varies with the group. When we start trying to classify interest groups, we can talk about primary, secondary, or just incidental. Do I need to explain that? Everybody pretty comfortable with that? Now, I'm relying on you to respond. We don't have time to do 2 weeks' worth of lecture all over again. Fair enough? This should be just like hitting the high points. Any part of it you don't understand, hang up a hand. We can deal with it. If you've got a local problem, but your national membership, are you going to do much good? So your membership or the potential membership kind of has to fit the nature of the problem. And of course, when it comes to organizing the group, you can either have individual memberships or it can be a organization that has groups in it. And do you want to have a single organization? Do you want to be organized at the local, state, and national level? Or the most complicated form is the confederated form, where you have groups that have one common goal, but their other goals, the other goals of each group, may not be the same. But they temporarily unite to push for that particular topic. And after they've succeeded, is there any reason to keep the organization alive until the next time you need it? Everybody understand that? Anybody understand that? I can go with yes, I can go with no, but silence, or shall I say, goldfish looks. Everybody know what a goldfish look is? How many of you have ever had a goldfish? When you're looking at them from your side of the tank, do they look like they're really thinking? So when I get a class that's just giving me goldfish looks, I wonder, you know, is their brain any bigger than that of that goldfish? Yet think about it. How big do you think a goldfish's brain is? Size of a grain of rice? Just a collected group of neurons that barely know how to function? Now, there are as many different classification schemas for interest groups as there are political scientists who study them. I'm just going to be very honest with you. So let's keep it simple. I believe in kissing a lot of these topics. That means keep it short and simple. You can put them all into one or two categories. Now, there's going to be some that don't fit, but it's not many, either economic or ideological. Is it possible that they can overlap and be both ideological and economic? Yeah. You know, okay, we're two-thirds economic and one-third ideological, or vice versa. I think the Koch brothers would be a good example. They've organized this Americans for Prosperity. Is it ideological? Yeah. But is it primarily focused on protecting the Koch brothers' economic interest? Yeah. So a bit of both. And we've already talked about this. We don't need to do it. Miss Blackwell, the bigger the group, the stronger the group, always, right?
Not always.
Why?
If they're not organized, they don't really...
Big problem. The bigger a group gets, the more different subgroupings within it are likely to be. And those subgroupings may not agree and might work at cross purposes. So you can get a really, really big group, but it's not well united. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to present a common face. On the other hand, a small group that's highly cohesive can make a lot of progress, but it's limited in how many people it has influence over. Then, of course, we're interested in the geographical distribution, economic resources. Generally, a rich group is better off than a poor group, but there are exceptions to that. Does a rich group, which doesn't have any public support, in fact, which the public is absolutely hostile to, have some problems? You can spend tons of money, and if the public thinks, if legislators and people in office know that supporting that group is like touching the third rail of a subway. You know what the third rail is? All right, nearly all subway systems operate by having two rails for the car to run on and a third rail, which is used for the electric. They don't want to put it up on the top, they just put it down there at the bottom. And so they pick up the electrical current by running along that third rail. And so when we talk about the third rail in politics, you get zapped because they're running 720 to 1400 volts. You have less loss of current the higher the voltage. And so you run that at the maximum potential voltage that your motors can handle. Now what they do on subways, for example, is they need like 220 alternating three-phase current. And so what they do is they have a step-down transformer in the subway car, but they don't lose as much power. Oh, well, you didn't really need to know that, do you? Reputation. If you've got a really great reputation, does that go a long way for you? Yeah. I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving is one of the very classic examples of a group that manages to put together almost all of this at the right way. I mean, is there any organization that comes out, Mothers for Drunks? No. Why do you join an interest group? How many of you have gotten any mail from a group that has a calendar and all you need to do is send in some money for the calendar, or if you join they'll give you, NPR is running their membership campaign, and if you pledge $10 a month they have, you know, mugs and they have bags and so forth. And I guess there are some people who join strictly because they want the material benefit. I think AARP is probably the classic example of that, in that you get these, all of these travel discounts, and they really can amount to a lot of money. You enjoy being with it. You have friends, etc. And then there's the ideological and shared belief. In the long run, that is probably the one that is most significant. People belong to groups other than economic groups because they have an ideological attachment to that. For example, conservation groups, etc. Fair enough? Now, what are the tools? Does every interest group use every one of these tools? Not really. It depends on the group, it depends on its membership, it depends on its goals. Lobbying, direct communication with people who are in a position to change the rules or change the power. That is an extremely important tool. Molding public opinion, shaping public opinion. Taking legal action if necessary. Suing. Picketing, strikes, protest. Now, why are these two in bold print, electioneering and campaign contributions? Well, the answer is, if you are a nonprofit group organized under Section 501(c)(3), then you can't do that. What if you're a nonprofit group organized under 501(c)(4)? Yeah, you can. That's a political action committee. Is it possible that a group can have a 501(c)(3) and a 501(c)(4) organization at the same time? Oh, sure. Maybe even the same officers. Caroline, that makes sense to you? For example, National Educational Group. Well, I'll give you a better one than that. The Texas Community College Teachers Association, of which I'm the membership services representative on this campus, is a 501(c)(3). How many campaign contributions have we ever made? Zero. How much direct involvement in political campaigns? Zero. But we also have a 501(c)(4) political action committee, and sometimes we do a little campaigning. Now, if you are anything 501(c)(3) or 501(c)(4) or whatever else, you have to register with the Texas Ethics Commission. Now, they keep the records of who has contributed to whom. And politicians must register in a sense in that they have to report what they have received and what they've spent and who they spent it on. And it's kind of fun to match the record sometimes, since that's been done on computer now. It costs you, and I've got a boo-boo here, I just realized they upped the price. It's $500, and I didn't see that when I was playing with this. It's now $500. Is that the sort of thing I'm likely to ask you on a test? Yeah. Is that going to be in place? I mean, the fact that I erred in putting it on the review sheet should tell you that it's not one of those things that we're going to live or die over. Any session of the legislature can change that price around, and they did. All right, it's my party, and I'll cry if I have to. Any group, however organized, what is the key difference between an interest group and a political party? Because there are some interest groups that look a lot like political parties and vice versa.
Political parties are trying to...
They're going to try to put candidates on the ballot to get them elected. Absolutely right. Everybody understands that? Political parties seek to get candidates on the ballot, be voted on. Interest groups do not. Now, sometimes an interest group may look a whole lot like a political party, and it may influence people to be on the ballot, particularly in nonpartisan elections, like the city of Houston. But they're not technically a political party. Now, there are a little conflict here. The book lays out for you on pages 326 through 327 a list of functions for political parties. Is it wrong? Absolutely not. Is it about the same thing that I've got up here in slightly different language? Yeah. So go ahead and take the one that's in the book. Fair enough. And let me go over those with you. Nominating party candidates. Is that up there? Well, kinda. How about recruiting candidates? Oh, definitely. Supporting candidates, contesting elections. Fundraising, supporting candidates. Let me tell you why the lists differ, and I think maybe next semester I'll go ahead and change my list to go with the same in the textbook. It depends on which authority looking at the functions of political parties and how they choose to report it that you use. Are they pretty much the same thing? What five functions could we universally agree that political parties have to perform? Or should perform? Finding candidates? Well, maybe. Why didn't... Is that universally always the case? Do the parties in Texas seek candidates, or do the candidates seek parties? Or is it sometimes a little of both? In some states, you have to have a minimum number of signatures from identified party members in order to be on the party primary ballot. Does Texas make that requirement? Nope. Anybody that's got the filing fee or the right number of signatures on a petition, even if they happen to be totally anathema to the party, can be on the party's in the party's primary. Do the parties generally tend to support their candidates? Well, yeah, but to what extent? Now, what's the fly in the ointment for this, folks? It gets confusing, doesn't it? Can a candidate be really more of a interest group candidate than they are a party candidate? If it's a low turnout election and an interest group manages to get their person that they're pushing on the party's ballot, is the party sworn to support that particular candidate and tell all the voters to vote for them? No. They can rail against them. They can say, well, they're rhinos. What's a rhino?
Republican
in name only, or dinos. Democrats in name only. They just got the nomination because they thought it would be easier to get elected as a Republican or get elected as a Democrat, and we don't really support them. To what extent do parties set the agenda, and to what extent do interest groups set the agenda? This can get kind of hairy, can't it? Really does. Now, do you want Mr. Waddell to come in and just pull the rabbit out of the hat and tell you this is the way it is? I will do that if you'd like, but I'm lying to you, because it's whichever political system you happen to have, in whichever state you happen to have, as to whether the parties are tremendously strong or tremendously weak. In states like Texas, which are, first off, it's basically a one-party Republican state right now, except in very localized areas, and those localized areas happen to be five of the six major metropolitan areas of the state of Texas, the Democrats tend to represent the urban area in the legislature, and the Republicans tend to represent the suburban and rural Texas, and that leads to some real interesting conflicts. Now, how's that going to play out in another 10 or 15 years? I'll leave it up to you to determine that. It's going to be fun. Be interesting. Of course, the Chinese used to say, Chinese peasants would say, may you live in interesting times. We did the party history stuff. How much of that we need to know? How about one question's worth? 2 points. Oh my, blow that off. Texas was a one-party Democratic state. Now, is that really a true statement? If you start studying Texas politics in any detail, was Texas really a one-party state prior to the 1960s? Oh, everybody who got elected was technically a Democrat. But there were some significant conflicts between what were known as the liberal slash progressive Democrats and the conservative corporate Democrats. I mean, it was no holes barred and Katie bar the door. Don't have a lot of that right now in the Democratic Party. Now, I will defer to a young lady who probably is well more familiar with this than I am. Are there any factions within the Republican Party?
Oh, yes.
So when you say Texas is a one-party Republican state, at least at the state level, is that a completely true statement?
No, sir.
Not on a bet. We could probably name at least three or four significant factions that spend more time fighting each other than they do anybody else. And they almost need to have a no-guns rule at the Republican State Convention. Knives are okay. Verbal knives are okay. Cut each other up. But I remember that from the Democratic Party days back in the 60s and 70s. What's a major party? One that weighs over 200 pounds? Got over 20% of the vote. Now, I got good news and bad news. Let me play with you for a second, Ms. Blackwell. Verbally only. Ms. Blackwell. Many years ago, there was a Democratic candidate running, a political party, a minor political party candidate running for governor, for a political party called La Raza Unita. All right, everybody familiar with Ramsey Munoz, La Raza Unita? At that time, the threshold was 10%. If you had 10% of the vote, you were a major party, and what then happens?
Would you go?
You have to use a primary to nominate your candidates. You can't have a convention to do it. Ramsey Munoz got over 10%, just barely over 10%, but over 10%. Now, both the Democrats and the Republicans in the legislature changed it to 20% and made it retroactive. Por qué? Who ends up paying for primaries? Mostly the state. You got the filing fees, pay a part of it, but 90%+ of the cost of primaries is borne by the state of Texas. And what was the proposed price tag for La Raza Unita to hold a primary? somewhere in the order of about $5 to $7 million. And probably would have gotten maybe 20,000 voters. Stop figuring, because you got to have all those polling places and all those ballots and whatnot everywhere, even though there's probably only five people going to show up to vote. So the legislature changed the rule to make it 20%. Now, I think if anybody got more than like 21 or 22%, they might retroactively change it to 30, but haven't gotten there. If you're a minor party and you're a candidate for governor, only for governor, if you don't run a candidate for governor, you don't have to worry about it. Do we have any political parties that don't run candidates for governor? The Green Party hasn't. Several years. They're probably not going to have to worry about the 20% rule anyway, but they don't fight at the state level. They're running candidates for president, mostly symbolic. Then you can use any legal method you want to, and most of them use conventions. What's a convention? It's people who identify with a particular political party who get together. In Iowa, they call them caucuses. Okay? Same difference. Convention, caucus. And the conventions choose their delegates. They have local conventions, county conventions, state conventions. All right, you're a political party. You've got to have the required machinery, which means at a minimum you have a county executive committee and a state executive committee, and you hold conventions at the precinct, county, or senatorial district and state level. That's the minimum. You got to make reports. Not particularly difficult, but you just have to jump through the hoops. Now, is Texas an open or a closed party state?
Closed.
Do you have to declare your party affiliation prior to the primary in order to participate in the primary? No. You got to have voter registration, you show up, and you become either a Democrat or a Republican, or you go to the precinct convention for a minor party. And that's what determines your membership. Now, you are a member of that party legally for the next 2 years. Now, the only political party activity that's really going to take place will be a primary 2 years hence, so technically you're still a Democrat or Republican or an independent for 2 years. You can't do, what was that name of the pop singer who the morning after they got married said, "Oops, I made a mistake." Anybody remember that? She actually did a song on "Oops, I Did It Again."
Britney Spears.
Yeah. So you can't do a Britney Spears. You can't say, "Oops, I made a mistake. I'm really not a Republican. I'm not really a Democrat." No. Does it make any difference? Really, it only makes one difference. If there's a runoff primary, do you remember what a runoff primary is? I had a student, I asked the question on a test one time, what is a runoff primary? And I couldn't count the answer wrong, but I couldn't help but laugh about it either. They said, that's where the parties hold an election to run off candidates. Well, not entirely wrong. How do you qualify to be in a runoff primary?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
If neither candidate...
Do you want to qualify to be in a runoff primary? Well, it's kind of yes and no.
I feel like you'd like to have 50% plus one vote so that you don't have to be in a runoff. But if you're going to be in a runoff, the top two candidates go.
Okay. The primary elections in Texas, now we're not counting local elections like city elections. Each city makes its own rules. Let's take Houston. Houston's got five candidates, the last I counted, running for mayor. What is the minimum vote threshold in order to be elected? I don't know is a legal answer today.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Do Do they have a majority?
You got to have a majority, which is 50%. Well, actually, majority is defined as more votes than all of the other candidates got combined. Don't even worry about percentages. You got 11 votes and all the other candidates got 10, you were elected. You got 9 votes and all the other candidates together got 11 votes, you didn't get elected. So you and the person who had the next highest number of votes are in a runoff election. My bet is, now does the city of Houston use plurality or majority? Plurality means the most votes. Majority means more than all the other candidates got.
Majority?
It uses a majority system. So there'll be a runoff for the mayorship of Houston. Now, if the election were being coterminous with the general election, that is where we elect members of Congress and members of the state legislature, or even the governor, is it majority or plurality?
Plurality.
Now pick on.
Plurality.
You're right. How do you know that?
I just guessed.
You just guessed. What's a good guess? But do you ever remember a runoff election after the November general election?
No.
When Rick Perry, but the very famous election, not his last election, but the election before last, got 39% of the vote and was still elected governor of Texas because that was more votes than anybody else got. Everybody comfortable with that? You understand the difference between a majority and a plurality election? If I pick on somebody over here, will you know the difference between a majority and a plurality election? Good. Should members of Congress be elected in majority vote elections or keep the plurality system? Should members of the state legislature, what do you find in countries that use majority vote systems? Much more incidence of serious third and fourth parties, multi-party systems. Because they can become that group, although it doesn't have enough votes to win, has enough votes to be the, I'm looking for a term, bargaining chip. See, if you're holding plurality elections, give me majority elections for the office, big office, you're also holding a plurality majority elections for things like Congress. And it's just possible that the XYZ party could get enough votes to be the difference between a majority in the parliament and a majority not in the parliament. If you try to understand Israeli politics, you've got to understand that Israelis use a plurality election for their parliamentary seats. And there are 11 organized political parties that compete, 4 of which are big parties. And Benjamin Netanyahu was nominated or elected the prime minister with about 36% of the vote. But he put together a coalition. Can make things very interesting. All right, what are the recent trends with parties? Have they become more or less important? Probably more important in the recruiting of candidates. Financing candidates? Hard to say. Put a quotation mark there. I mean, not a quotation, but an asterisk with the role of political action committees. Managing campaigns, definitely. Both political parties now have really organized. Have we seen increased levels of partisanship at almost all levels of politics in Texas? Yes. And we can debate whether that's good or bad. And we've seen a merger of state and national politics. Now, we played with media. This is going to be short and sweet. Short, I don't know how sweet. What's the most detailed source of information about what's going on in politics in Texas? The major daily newspapers. And I probably should put the word major daily newspapers up there. Does radio and television give you much real information about state and local politics in Texas? No. You might figure out who the governor is. You might accidentally know who the state representative is. But if we're talking about KHOU or Channel 13 or one of those in Houston, they've got about 50 House members and about 7 state senators to deal with. And they can't really spend a whole lot of time going into that in any depth. So they just mention them. When do they normally mention a member of the Texas legislature on the evening news? When they're indicted for a crime or something like that, most times. Or when they really do something exceptional. But most of the time, you never hear of them. We really don't have much in the way of magazines at the state issue, so nearly all the magazines you might read will cover politics at the national level, but not at the state level. Is the internet increasingly becoming a major source of news on politics? Yes. But what's the problem there?
Nobody hardly looks at it.
Well, there's a lot of people who do the internet now. But what's the biggest problem? It's called the echo chamber effect. Which blog sites do you pay attention to? Which websites do you go to? The ones that reinforce what you already think, or the ones that challenge you? There is one extremely good website that I'm going to point out to you. I meant to do it and I did not. I think I might have mentioned it, but I'm not sure. Did I mention the Texas Tribune?
Yes.
I thought I did. It is an online news magazine. And it strikes a pretty good balance between conservative and liberal philosophy. I challenge you to try to figure out where they stand on any given issue. They've had very good interviews with politicians of all political stripes in recent years. Well worth your time. Well, what's happening in the media? Concentration of ownership to major corporations. Now, if you're a major corporation, with the exception of Fox News, do you want to honk anybody off? Will it work against, what is the basic purpose of the news media? To inform, to entertain, or to make money?
Make money.
To make money. They can't stay in business if they don't make money. And automatically honking off a huge chunk of your potential listening audience is not a smart move. I don't know if you have been following this, but there were several television shows that really raised a few hackles a while back, and their supporters, which were numerous, persuaded advertisers to strictly to drop their advertising on that show. Glenn Beck went from having almost a cash cow to struggling because they mounted a very serious effort to get advertisers not to advertise on his show and dropped his advertising revenue by about 2/3. Capital Press Corps, Texas has got one of the best. But if you really want to follow politics in Texas well, the Dallas Morning News, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Houston Chronicle, or the Austin American-Statesman are your best sources. San Antonio Light, Express News, and San Antonio Express News, used to be a light but it disappeared, or the El Paso Times are adequate. You're not going to get a whole lot out of Galveston Daily News or the Friendswood Journal because they don't focus on it. They don't focus on state politics. And then, of course, radio and television tend to look at the sensational stuff. Two groups, the Freedom of Information Foundation and Texas Media, kind of basically opposite sides of the same coin. The one that really works on the open records and open meetings thing is the Texas Freedom of Information Foundation. Texas Media is the lobbying group, and they're the sweetness and light. They're the Siamese twins of media organizations. We talked about PAC journalism, the fact that they paid press agents, etc. I just kind of want you to be very, very generally familiar with this, but don't get your underwear in a twit. Agenda setting and agenda building are two main functions of the media. Deciding what's going to be covered, and then shaping the public discourse is also important. Media get involved in campaigns through sound bites, through advertising, and that's pretty much all I want to deal with on that. Now let me change gears with you for a second. How many of you did your reading test questions? All right. I'm going to ask a few questions. What are the qualifications to vote in Texas? Minimum qualifications to register.
To register. An ID.
Can you talk a little louder? I'm standing here by you and I can't hear you.
Some kind of form of ID that you're a citizen.
All right, give them to me by category. We got four sweet little girls that live down the street. Their ages are 8, 5, and 3. Can they register?
No, they have to be 18.
Have to be 18. Age?
Oh,
you're just stretching. Jessica?
They must be a citizen.
You have to be a citizen.
Of the United States, be at least 18 years of age.
Yeah.
Have a residence in Texas for at least 30 days.
Yep. Texas and or the district in which you are intending to register for 30 days. That's straightforward, no problem. Now, there were numerous barriers that were erected to keep minorities from voting. Texas didn't have all of them. Can you name me three?
On what you can't.
Poll tax.
Grandfather clause.
Literacy test.
Literacy test. We never used a literacy test in Texas, but other places did.
Suffrage. Believe in suffrage.
Suffrage is the general statement of who can vote.
And a white primary.
White primary. Texas had a white primary. Now, the way that worked was the Democratic Party was declared by law to be a private organization and could decide who would be there. We said it was a one-party state, right? So the only real election was in the primary. And what if you can't vote in the primary? Do you really have a voice in the election?
Nope.
No. So the two we know that were used in Texas.
Was it white primary?
White primary.
And the poll tax.
And you've named two of the three.
Grandfather.
Poll tax.
Okay, and the grandfather.
And then extremely lengthy residency requirements. Do poor people tend to move around more than wealthy people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tend to be, particularly in the 19th and 20th century, they went to where the work was. And if you have to live somewhere for at least a year before you can even register to vote, and then we require you to register a year before the election, what are your chances of being able to vote?
Not good.
Wait a minute, you said we had an elitist system? Do you think this helps promote the maintenance of an elitist system? If you deny low-income and minority people the opportunity to vote, yes, you do. It definitely reinforces it. So what happened to the poll tax, the poll tax, residency requirements, and the white primary?
It went away.
Well, the white primary was declared to be a violation of the 15th Amendment.
Residency stayed, right?
15th Amendment says you cannot deny people the right to vote by virtue of their race, color, previous condition of servitude. We had a constitutional amendment adopted which outlawed taxes as a prerequisite. And then the Voting Rights Act of 1965 actually didn't set the definite length of residency requirement that said unreasonable residency requirements will be outlawed. And the Supreme Court basically said anything over 30 days, which is an administrative, is unreasonable. So that basically took care of those three. All right, I'm thinking about running for XY office. And it's an office which is elected in the November general election, the partisan election. How can I get on the ballot?
Oh. Which party would
for
the,
you like? No, now. It doesn't matter, does it?
Well, that's true. Yeah, you could be an independent.
I want on the general election ballot for November.
You got to win the primary party.
I can win the party's nomination.
Or get nominated.
Or you could file as an independent.
I can file as an independent.
Filing fee or have a petition
right.
with a certain number of signatures.
One of the two. Now, if I want to be on the party primary ballot, that's a different story, isn't it? All I've got to do is pay a filing fee or get enough signatures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're really paying attention to that, you'll say, Mr. Waddell, you just about said the same thing twice, didn't you? Except for one thing. Can I qualify as an independent for the general election ballot by just paying a filing fee?
No.
Nope. Got to have those signatures. Now, I didn't mention this in the general discussion, but I want to do it now. If somebody approaches you in the parking lot and says, so-and-so wants to be on the ballot to run for president, and he's not going to get to be nominated by one of the major parties, but if you'll sign the petition, we get enough signatures on the petition, we can get him on the ballot in Texas in November. Okay, and they hand you a pen. Read the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
What does the fine print say?
I don't know. What does it say?
I hereby declare that I am independent, and this is my candidate. So if I go to vote in the Democratic or Republican primaries or any of the other minor party primaries, can I do so? I've already declared my party affiliation. Let me tell you how that came down a few years ago. Do you remember H. Ross Perot running for president? Okay, you're all too young for that. He got on the ballot as an independent by having people sign petitions, etc. They showed up at the primary to vote because they wanted to vote for the local candidates. And they're on the list of people who signed the petition, and therefore they're ineligible to participate in the primary. Anna, I was an election judge. And there were a lot of really honked off people. What do you mean? I can't vote. You declared yourself an independent, and that means you're not eligible to vote in the primary. Nobody told me that. Do you remember that fine print on the top of that thing that you didn't pay attention to read before you signed it? Yeah. It told you that I recognize that by signing this petition, I make myself ineligible to participate in the activities of any other political party or to nominate an independent for the same office. So if somebody else had gotten you, wanted somebody else to run, you couldn't do it. Now, for a different party, that'd be another story.
Now, if voting in a primary makes you affiliated with that party for 2 years, then you couldn't sign the petition.
But it's in that election cycle. Primary. It's in that election cycle.
Okay, but if I vote...
I know, it's just one of those peculiarities in the law. You're trying to be logical about that law. That law says that you must collect the signatures in a period 90 days before the ballot is shaped up.
But if they collected the signatures 90 days before the general election, then I would have already voted in the primary.
That's right. But I'm telling you, that's one of the inconsistencies in the statute. It says it's like, oops, it doesn't matter, we'll do it this way. You're trying to make it logical. And in this instance, it's not. Yeah, technically you're a Republican and now you've said you're an independent. Yeah, but, or you said you're a Democrat and you say you're an independent, but sorry about that. It's just one of those inconsistencies. What is a referendum? They're going to have a referendum in Houston on the anti-discrimination ordinance. City legislature passed an ordinance and under the city charter, if you get enough signatures on a petition, you can challenge the legality of the ordinance in a referendum. What's a referendum? It's an election on an issue. Are we going to have any referenda issues on the ballot in November here in Galveston? Anna says yes. Anybody else want to say something?
Yeah.
What are they?
Probably women's rights and stuff like that.
Actually, we're going to go over those before the election. There are 7 constitutional amendments on the ballot. Is that a referendum?
Yes.
Yes. Sure is. And I intend to pass out a little sheet on them. Can anybody in here name me any one of those proposed constitutional amendments?
No.
Don't feel bad. Until I read up on them, I couldn't either. So I'll give you a sheet. There's a sort of a grassroots campaign to defeat one of the referendum issues for an interesting reason. Right now, all statewide office holders are required by the Texas Constitution to live in Austin. That is their permanent residence. This proposed constitutional amendment will say, no, they can live anywhere in the state they want to. They can have their legal address anywhere in the state they want to. Now, let me give you the backstory on this very fast. Paxton has been indicted. The Attorney General of Texas has been indicted. In fact, several indictments. If he were convicted and sent to prison, he still would be Attorney General of Texas because there is no procedure to remove it, and having been convicted of a felony does not remove you from office in Texas. He couldn't run again, but he couldn't be removed. Legislature The legislature cannot remove a public official for a crime committed prior to the time they were elected. But if he's sent to prison and there's no prison in Austin, he won't live in Austin, so he automatically loses his job. So it's an irrelevant issue that's going to have an impact on it. What is voter turnout?
How many people turn out to vote?
Okay. What are the 2 ways we use to calculate voter turnout? Well, it's called VAP and VEP. VAP, we take the Census Bureau's definition of how many people are over the age of 18 that have not been convicted of felonies, divide the number of people who voted by the total number of people who were eligible to vote, who were in that voting age group, and get a turnout figure. Voting eligible takes how many people were registered to vote. Is that one and the same? Oh, no. So which number is always going to have a higher percentage? VAP or VEP? VEP, voting eligible. The number of voting eligible is usually about half or so the VAP number. So how many of you had basic math? If you double the size of the denominator, does it change the fraction? Oh yeah, big time. We've done that. Let's see. Back row. One of y'all, Mr. Randall. How does Texas voter turnout compare with the nation as a whole? Higher? Lower? How does Texas voter turnout differ from that of the national averages? Higher or lower?
Lower, right?
I can't hear you.
Lower.
Yeah. If we rank 46th or 47th in terms of overall turnout, with 1 being the most and 50 being the zero, or the least, we're kind of scraping almost the bottom of the barrel, aren't we? Now, what 2 factors probably help explain that? This is where we take that stuff we learned in the first unit and use it. How does Texas' educational level compare with the rest of the country? I mean, the highest or the lowest quartile?
Lowest.
Nowhere. We probably have a higher quartile.
Lower. We have a highest percentage of people with high school diplomas and so forth?
Mm, probably not.
No. We're down there toward the bottom of the barrel, aren't we? There are three key things that help you determine whether a person is going to vote. First off, whether they're eligible, registered to vote. Do we have a large immigrant population in Texas that's not eligible to vote? Okay. Do we have a fairly poorly educated population as a whole? Yeah. Those are two strikes against us to begin with, aren't they? Now, the other things you can look at are degree of party competition. In most districts, is there a high degree of competition? No. Most of the legislative districts in Texas are pretty overwhelmingly, they've been gerrymandered to be pretty overwhelmingly Democratic or pretty overwhelmingly Republican. So by the time you get to the general election, it's a foregone conclusion. And states that have high degrees of competition tend to have high degrees of turnout. States where the election is pretty much a foregone conclusion, you know, why bother? And then there are other little factors like how easy it is the state makes it to vote and that sort of thing too. But that's something of a major interest to political party. We already discussed white primary, didn't we? That's a primary where people took a bucket of white paint and pulled, and what painted the whiting of the polling place. Is that right? I know that sounds dumb. Big time dumb. I asked that as an open-ended question on a test one time. I said, what is a white primary? What was the white primary? And somebody said, all the ballots were printed on white paper and all the ballot boxes were white.
Lord, give me strength.
I haven't picked on you yet. Ain't here. Oh, it's, let's see, A&M. What does that shirt say? Ain't, okay. Okay. Can I pick on you for a second? What are the two types of primaries that states can hold? Open or closed, right? Closed primary is if you just show up with a voter registration and say, I want to vote in Iowa, and they look at your voter registration, and for party affiliation, there's nothing there. Can you vote in the primary?
No.
Nope. Because you have to have declared yourself to either be a Democrat or a Republican at least 60 days prior to the election, and it's put on the poll list. And if you're a declared Republican, you get the Republican ballot. If you're a declared Democrat, you get the Democratic ballot. They don't have party-conducted primaries, but when they have the primary, it's like with early voting. You give them the ballot. But in Texas, could you give them either ballot? Why?
Because you don't have to declare your party.
That's right. It's an open primary state. Everybody clear on that? Kathy? Good. Okay, you're an interest group. Who do you register with before you start making campaign contributions or lobbying?
Texas
Ethics
Commission.
Say again? Texas Ethics Commission, right. Now, is this a freebie?
Nope. What?
Do you get to do it for free?
No, there's annual members.
Nope, they pay you. I mean, they charge you. No, they don't pay you, they charge you.
Annual membership.
And you have to report how much money you've spent and who you spent it on if it's a covered expense,
right.
Meaning it's under the law. Now, can you lobby without spending any money and not have to register?
No.
Yeah, you can.
I mean, yes.
You're exercising your First Amendment rights. Notice I didn't say as an interest group, as an individual. You have First Amendment rights. If you are not an organized interest group, do you have to register with the Texas Ethics Commission in order to lobby? No. Do you have to register with the Texas Ethics Commission in order to campaign? No. Now, here's one that trips up a lot of people. Let's say I'm going to give $1,000 to a candidate. Do I have to register with the Texas Ethics Commission to give them $1,000? No. Only if I'm an organized interest group do I have to register. Individuals don't have to register. But how am I going to know, how am I, the outside observer, going to know that you contributed $1,000 to candidate X? He has to report it. He or she has to report it. They have to report any contribution of over $50. I have a story to tell you. We're going to get through pretty quick. When I was running for county chairman, and by the way, running even for county chairman, you have to report this. At that time, it was with a different group, Secretary of State then, but now it's the Ethics Commission. A fellow walked up to me and handed me a $50 bill and said, "Give me a penny." Did I tell you this story? He said, "Give me a penny." I said, "Why?" He said, "Don't argue with it. Give me a penny." I got home and it dawned on me. That was $49.99. Does he have to report it? No. Now, one other loophole is if you have a campaign event and somebody puts a $50 bill or a $100 bill in the contributions bin, you just report cash contributions. You don't have to report the person because they didn't sign that $50 bill or that $100 bill. So if you want to make a sub rosa contribution at some point, just put it in cash in their till. I didn't tell you to do that. Are there any limits other than judicial races? Are there any limits on how much an individual or an interest group can contribute to a candidate's campaign in Texas?
No.
Now, this is the question where the logical thought on it is wrong. Logically, you would say, yeah, there's got to be limits on how much people can contribute.
No.
But what's the reality in Texas?
There is no limit.
There are no limits except in judicial races. There are no limits. If I wanted to give you $1 million, I can give you $1 million. I just got to report it. Trust me, Anna, I'm telling you the truth.
Has that changed?
No, it's been that way all along. In judicial races, there are limits. But for other political campaigns, you got to report them. But you can contribute as much as you want to. Now, at the presidential level, there are national limits on how much can be contributed to congressional candidates or presidential candidates, but not state law.
Okay.
Fair enough? You're thinking federal law. Yeah, federal law says there are, but state law says not. If you want to really look at it, go back and look at Governor Perry's campaign contributions. He receives, I think, two contributions in excess of $1 million.